Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today started off as a journalist in the British press before moving to New York as the bureau chief for first The Guardian and then The Times. She then moved on to magazines, editing Marie Claire and then becoming editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan. She's now a media supremo, working across many areas in content from television shows to sitting on the board of Snapchat. She's recently been awarded an OBE, and her new book, Love Rules, has been published by HarperCollins. Joanna Coles, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here, although there aren't any other writers around the table.
Well, you're absolutely right. We pondered about that, actually, about that plural, but we thought in the end that you were meeting a lot of them, although not all at the same time.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I just want to reassure the listener, there aren't any other writers, it's just me. So you can switch off now if you want.
The thing is, though, you've been a writer for a very long time.
Oh,
because
God.
When you were a child, you actually put together your own magazine.
I did. When I was, I can't remember if I was 11 or 12, I put together a magazine with my best friend who lived next door. And we, and I think this is what you're referring to, sent a copy to the Queen. And actually, I feel like we created junk mail because we used to deliver it to all our neighbours too, regardless of whether or not they wanted it. You just threw it through the letterbox. Anyway, rather thrillingly, 2 months after we dispatched it to the Queen and forgotten all about it, we got a wonderful letter back from her lady-in-waiting saying Her Majesty had thoroughly enjoyed copies of Your Choice, which was what it was called, and was looking forward to new issues. And so that was all the encouragement I needed.
And hence your sparkling career off the back of this early move, clearly.
Well, I don't know if it's sparkling, but it's certainly been a career full of fun and full of writing and journalism, which I've loved. Hopefully it's not over yet either. I do have more to say.
Where did you go from that early start? I know that you went to the University of East Anglia.
I did. I spent 3 years at UEA doing the course called EAS, which is English and American Studies. And at the time, and it's extraordinary to think of this now, it was only UEA and Nottingham that offered a course doing English and American Literature / Studies, which really meant history. And it was an absolutely terrific course and incredibly relevant. And when I eventually went on to take American citizenship, one of the things they wanted was proof that I'd actually done this at university because it showed a consistent interest in American culture.
So very useful even back then. Did you have a sense then that that was where you wanted to end up? Was New York always calling you?
I did, because when you grow up in the north of England, as I had done in the 60s and 70s, it was not a cheering place. And the most exciting thing that would ever happen to me all week was actually to watch new episodes of Mary Tyler Moore from America. And it was only when I got to New York did I realise that actually Mary Tyler Moore was filmed in Minneapolis. And by the time I got to New York and discovered that actually, if I really wanted to be Mary Tyler Moore, I had to go to Minneapolis. I was like, no, that's enough. Thank you. I'm going to stay in New York. But it's hard to imagine. There were brownouts, constant miners' strikes. It felt very depressing. And I always wanted to go to America because from the television, that was where energy and the bright lights were.
But your first move was to London.
From UEA, I moved to London. I worked for The Spectator for 2 years, and then I moved to The Telegraph. And I like to say I went in from the right wing, then moved to The Guardian, and The Guardian eventually posted me to New York.
And from there, you didn't stay with the paper for that long. You actually moved on to The Times.
I moved to The London Times, where I worked for 3 years, really travelling around America, writing about all sorts of things that were going on. It was a fantastic job, if you were me, because it was really very straightforward. You set off with a notebook and a pen, and you trotted across America, turning up at places where there were either big stories or that you were interested in. And from there, when I had my second son, who coincidentally is your nephew, I felt I couldn't travel on a whim, which was really what you needed to do the job well. It wasn't the job's fault. My life no longer fitted it. And so I moved into magazines.
Had you ever done that kind of work before? I mean, your work was quite focused on current affairs, on politics, not so much on the lighter side, on magazine stuff.
Well, I love news, and I was lucky enough to work for some of the best news organisations in the world, the Times of London, The Guardian, and I also worked for the BBC at one point. So I felt I went through a period of withdrawal not working on a daily news show or newspaper when I moved to New York Magazine, which was a weekly magazine and really about the life of the city. But then, in fact, what happened was, as I started, we had 9/11. And so the magazine became a sort of chronicle of the city recuperating after that extraordinary event. And then I went into magazine management, really as an evolution of my career. I went to edit Marie Claire, and after Marie Claire, Cosmopolitan, which in America is really the dominant women's media brand. In fact, it is globally. There are 45 issues of Cosmopolitan across the globe. And at a time, it was just the beginning of the new feminist reawakening. And so, again, it was very exciting. We were able to tie it in to big events going on in the news.
And, I mean, you moved Cosmo on from sex tips and quizzes to have much more substance and much more relevance to women of today.
Well, when I took over Cosmo, I spent a lot of time thinking about what Helen Gurley Brown, who truly was the great editor of the 20th century, she really created the template for all modern magazines. What she had done, and she had taken over Cosmopolitan, which was up until then a small literary magazine, in 1965, which was the same year that the Food and Drug Administration in America approved the pill, which really changed life for women in America and indeed Western Europe. But particularly America, where Helen was, she was able to create a magazine around the concept that women were now going to have sex for pleasure, not just for procreation. And it was a different kind of sexual empowerment. And it meant you could be single as a woman, you didn't have to get married to have sex, everything was changing. And so Helen embarked on her own revolution. And I thought, when I got there, what am I going to do? What's happening for women in the culture? And I had gone to see Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, and this was about 6 years ago. And as we were talking, she had somewhat shyly pushed across the desk at me a manuscript of what would become Lean In and asked me if I would read it. And I stuffed it in my bag thinking, oh God, a business book, not really up for this, but whatever. And after I left, I went off to the Palo Alto shopping mall, and I had half an hour before my next appointment. So I ordered a cappuccino and opened the folder that she'd given me and started reading. And 2.5 hours later, I was still reading. The mall had closed around me. I'd missed my next appointment. And I thought, God, this book is extraordinary. And for those who haven't read it, not only is it an anthem to women's ambition, but it also, for the first time, pulled together all the research which showed that despite the fact that women graduated at the same, if not higher levels than men at college and had been doing this for 30 years, they were woefully behind in the managerial and leadership roles in our culture. And so that was when I realized, oh, there's a whole new feminist reawakening happening. We need to get behind this book. I immediately put her in a chokehold to become Cosmo's careers correspondent. And we did a 24-page excerpt of Lean In, which coincided with my first issue.
There's a perhaps apocryphal story about you getting one of your first big editing jobs and just not taking no for an answer when the person couldn't see you.
Well, it's not apocryphal. It's true. I think you're referring to the fact that I went for a job interview actually to be the editor of Marie Claire. And for various boring miscommunications, I arrived for the interview having had my hair blown out and, you know, wearing a sparkling new suit, to be told that the person who was interviewing me, the head of the company, was in fact on her way to the airport to a meeting in France, and that I had missed the message telling me this. And so I said, well, where is she now? Perhaps I could meet her en route to the airport. And they said, well, she's actually about to leave her house. And they called her and she said, if she can get here in 5 minutes, she can ride with me to the airport. So I tore out of the building. I literally stood in the middle of Sixth Avenue, stopped a cab, pulled the poor passenger out of the back, threw him to the curb, shouted at the driver to take me where I needed to go. And as we got to the address on Park Avenue, where Kathy Black, the name of the executive, was then pulling out from her apartment, I saw her car and we drag raced up Park Avenue until she saw me frantically waving, pulled over her car. I hopped into her air-conditioned black limo, and by the time I got to the airport, I knew I had the job.
I ask you that because you were talking about Sheryl Sandberg and ambition, and sometimes it's seen as a dirty word for feminine women, but it's not something we were meant to do, as your life clearly shows. there's nothing wrong with a healthy dose of ambition.
Well, I didn't see that as ambition, as just I've had my hair blown out, I'd had a manicure, I'd bought a new suit, I was not going to miss the opportunity to get something that I really wanted to get. And I knew if I waited another week, the energy and my excitement about the whole thing would have faded. And I just wanted to nail the deal.
And it was fabulous. Marie Claire worked well, Cosmopolitan worked well, and you're now, of course, in management of Hearst. Tell me what that role entails.
Well, I'm currently the chief content officer, which means I oversee editorial for the 279 magazines that Hearst has globally, and that includes Harper's Bazaar, Elle, Marie Claire, Good Housekeeping, Esquire. It's a wonderful list. In America, it includes Oprah's magazine, the Food Network magazine, HGTV, which is Home and Garden magazine. Then we have Elle Decor, Veranda, which is a wonderful magazine all about big, very expensive homes, House Beautiful. We have 20 magazines. And I recently started a magazine called Airbnb Mag with Airbnb, which is really a new kind of travel magazine for their users, which is really for travellers, not for tourists. So it's for people who want to experience life. If you're living in Paris or you're travelling to Paris, you live life as a Parisian while you're there, as opposed to a tourist staying in an American or British hotel and sort of eating British and saying, well, the French do things very oddly, don't they? It's a much more integral way of travelling and much more fun and authentic.
And as well as overseeing all of this content, of course, you're creating your own, not only your book, which we're going to talk about in some detail in a moment, but television too.
Well, I'm very fortunate to have a wonderful show at the moment, which I executive produce, called The Bold Type. And I can say it's wonderful because it's really an enormous team that produce it. And I'm a tiny cog in that machinery. But just launched season two last week to actually wonderful reviews, which is very exciting. And the goal for that was to try and reflect some of my own experiences in my working life with female colleagues and also as a female boss. And I felt, looking at the way that working women were portrayed on television, I couldn't find anything that reflected my own experiences. And if you think of how men are portrayed, they're heroic figures, they're firemen, they're doctors, they're always in control. And even when you have a woman who's doing a senior job, like perhaps in Scandal or Grey's Anatomy, the woman is always sort of incapable of making a decision. She's always sleeping with the lead protagonist. And it just felt a mess to me. It wasn't my experience of the working life, where actually the women I'd worked with were incredible mentors to me, incredibly helpful. And the roles I saw them in, they were operating incredibly effectively. And so I wanted to replicate that. And it focuses on one female boss, who's the opposite of The Devil Wears Prada, and then three young women who are great friends and often in competition with each other, but they don't tear each other down. They're just trying to get a grip, experience or begin on the adventure of life. And I'm a big journal keeper, so there are all sorts of anecdotes from my own working life which form part of the show.
Is she you?
She's not me, no, but there are elements of it that are very much taken from my life. And then, of course, there's lots of creativity from the writer's room itself. But there are all sorts of anecdotes that we've tickled up. One of my favourite, actually, is of a dear friend and I worked together at the Daily Telegraph, and she was sued, actually. And when the lawyer came to debrief her and get her notes, he was horrified because when she opened her notebook, it had sort of coffee stains on it and was full of doodles and half-written quotes. And so we were able to transfer that to a character being sued in the show who, when she opens her notebook, in fact, it turns out she has wine stains everywhere and the lead quotes have been smudged out by wine. In real life, it was coffee, but wine's funnier.
Absolutely. You're also involved in technology.
Well, I'm on the board of Snapchat, Snap Inc., which is great fun.
And you're a prolific social media user yourself. Is that necessary, do you think, in terms of people's careers these days? I mean, this is the new way to get messages out.
Well, I think it's an important part of being in the media. If you're in the media and you're in management, as I am, it gives you a way of staying plugged into that creative part of yourself. I've been doing a lot of social media recently because I've had a book come out, but actually I'm ready to go a bit dark just because it's a lot of work. And I think to do social media well, it's almost a full-time job, actually. But I do think it's a way of engaging in the conversation information right now, which is interesting. And of course, it's a way of letting people know what you're doing.
In your opinion, what is the best method to do that? I know that you use Instagram a lot, and it seems to me that people are very much, particularly after the latest scandals, moving away from Facebook. Twitter is not relevant to everyone. Insta, is that where it's at?
Well, actually, I use Snap predominantly between friends. So when I'm communicating and I want to do a silly picture or my hair looks terrible or I'm messing around, I will connect with friends on Snap. I use Instagram if I'm trying to sell something. So it was my book for some time. That automatically repeats on Facebook. And then Twitter, I'm on Twitter a lot, actually, because I'm commenting on what other people are doing. I'm putting things out there. If we get a great review for the bold type, which we have done recently, or when I got some of the very nice, generous coverage of my book, I would circulate that on Twitter because I know other media is on Twitter and so they're picking it up. So I think it depends what you're doing. And if you just want to put a nice picture out there and communicate that, it's quite fun being on Insta. But I think that for intimacy and fun, it's Snap. To reach other media, I use Twitter. To sort of reach some of the people in my sort of fashion circles through some of the media titles that I work with at Hearst, I use Insta.
Now, onto your book, Love Rules, How to Find a Real Relationship in a Digital World. And obviously, your digital use is relevant here, but so is your magazine experience. And I'm gathering that coming out of Cosmo, you would have had a chance to observe so many relationships and speak to so many women about this. Was that the genesis of the book?
Yes, I felt that women were wrestling with how do they build relationships. And so much of our communication has really morphed online. And I think it's now 25% of marriages begin on a dating app. And I'm a huge fan of dating apps. The book is not remotely anti-digital. But the flip side of dating apps is that you can feel interchangeable, you can feel disposable. And I know myself how I shop for things when I'm on Net-a-Porter or I'm on Matches.com and I'm putting things in my virtual shopping basket, but I don't commit to purchase. It's almost as if putting the $6,000 jacket in the bag is as good as buying it. And then the next morning, I can just remove item. And so I sensed that a lot of people were feeling frustrated with dating apps, and they don't come with operating instructions, which is actually would be really helpful. And so that's what this book is, operating instructions for a real relationship. And I think there is a sense in which we are beginning to come to terms with the impact of spending so much time on our devices, on our actual lives and our abilities to communicate with each other. And we now see in millennials, we have a generation who would rather stab themselves than actually pick up the telephone and call someone. And so we see that that's gone by the by. But actually, the communication you have online, especially if you're texting back and forth, does not give you as many clues as to what the other person you're dealing with is actually trying to say. And if you're meeting someone online, I noticed what was happening was that people would spend an inordinate amount of time in flirty exchanges going back and forth. And then if they eventually got that relationship offline and into real life, they would be incredibly disappointed and crushed with disappointment that the person was not who they hoped they would be. And in fact, when I started looking into it, and the book has a lot of science and a lot of research into it, I talked to Mary Aitken, one of the best cyber psychologists out there, who talks a lot about what happens when you communicate in a computer-mediated environment. And what you do is you create an online self who is actually disconnected from your real self. And so when you're in a conversation with a stranger online, there are really four people in the conversation. There are the two online selves who you're hoping are witty and clever and are communicating at an artificial level. And then there are the two real selves. And what happens is that we as human beings tend to attribute positive attributes in the gaps in our knowledge of that person. So when you do actually meet them in real life, if you do, you think you are meeting someone different to who you're actually meeting. I cannot stress enough how important it is to actually pick up the phone before you commit to meeting a stranger you've met online in real life. Pick up the phone and talk to them for 8 minutes and you'll know whether or not this is someone worth your time. Mm. And I can't tell you how many people I spoke to who said, oh my goodness, we spent a month going back and forth. It was the highlight of my day, these funny, sexy text exchanges. And then they would meet the person in real life and take one look at them and know, oh my goodness, no, what a waste of time. And then the person would say to them, oh, that was so much fun, thank you, but I can see this, we have nothing in common, I don't want to waste your time, see ya.
Yes, the whole book is really, it's structured like a diet, isn't it?
It's structured like a diet because I felt that women think about food all the time. I don't know a single woman that doesn't sit down and do some sort of mental calculation around whatever she is eating. And I thought about how there is junk food and there is junk love. It's very easy to get hooked on a toxic diet in the same way that it's easy to get hooked on toxic relationships. And there's a section in which I liken hookups to French fries, which means that once in a while they might be absolutely fine, but you can't consist on a diet of them. You can't exist on a diet of exclusively of French fries. And if you do, you'll end up with all sorts of health problems in the same way that if you end up on a diet of hookups, you'll do the same thing. Also, I talk a lot about porn in the book, which is the big game changer in terms of digital love. And in America in particular, it's really default sex education because we don't get any sex education in America. And if of the states, of the 50 states, only 13, this is an incredible statistic for a European to get their head around, only 13 are mandated that the information they give is medically accurate, which means that you have by far the majority of states who don't need to do that. And we have states that teach creationism. It's quite extraordinary. And so porn has become default sex education for a whole generation of boys and girls. And of course, the point of porn is that it's seen through the lens of a camera, usually a male director. And what looks good on porn and what's stimulating on porn isn't necessarily what feels good in real life. And I heard repeatedly when I talked to young women who I talk to all the time, I'm on college campuses, I go to young women's business groups, that they felt they were competing with porn because if they didn't put out at the end of a date, the guy would go back and just call up Pornhub or whatever his porn of choice on his cell phone. It's so widely available now. And that also you have this extraordinary syndrome called masturbatory idiosyncratic syndrome, which is where young men in particular develop specific kinds of fetishes or desires around specific kinds of porn, and they quite quickly build up tolerance to it so that you're looking for ever more extreme versions of that. And this didn't feel to me like this was actually related to real sex and the joy of real sex and the intimacy of real sex when you get it right.
What about finding the one? I mean, you've talked about dating apps, but will the universe provide? Is there someone out there for all of us?
Well, I don't like the idea of the one. There are many people out there at certain times in your life that you hopefully will come across and be able to create a connection with. And my goal for the book is not to help people find the one, but to find a bigger life. And if you expand your circle of friends and you do more things and get off your device, and I worry, as a side note, that people are becoming voyeurs of other people's lives on social media at the expense of participating in their own life. If you get off your device at a certain point and you get out into the world and you join a sports team or a choir or a theatre group or your local broadcasting station or you're active doing things, working in a voluntary organisation, you come across people with whom you have shared values and you then build a network around that and you are more likely to come across people that you like. The more you like people, the more they like you, and that's actually how you get to know someone. Mm. And I worry that the false promise, perhaps, in dating apps is that we will, with a series of algorithms, fit you with the right one for you. And of course, there are many people that you would have a wonderful relationship with. And what you want to do is have a big life, meet lots of people, and hopefully connect with someone.
Mm. The book gives us lots of proper rules. So, for instance, keep a love journal.
I think one of the most interesting things that people forget about is how important it is to observe and understand your own patterns of behaviour. And when I was looking into how people come to terms with their own eating habits, so much advice from nutritionists is about keep a journal, keep a food journal, so you're actually tracking what you eat and you're honest about it. And I thought, wouldn't that be interesting if people did that with love journals, where they wrote down their goals, they wrote down the people they actually spent time with, they wrote down the people whose energy made them feel good or whose energy made them feel bad, and they became their own data analytics expert. What's more interesting than your own data? We're all supposed to be data analytics experts. So turn yourself into the thing that you're studying. And if you collect the data, i.e. your journal entries over a period of time, you begin to see patterns of behavior. And it's incredibly interesting. What triggers you? You know, when do you end up with an old boyfriend? Is it when you're drunk? Is it when you're lonely? Is it when your best friend is rushing off to hold yet another pre-engagement party? I mean, what is it that triggers you and makes you feel anxious that you make the wrong decisions? Because once you understand that, in the same way that you understand what makes you eat three Mars bars and not one, because one will be okay over a period of some time, it's the third Mars bar that brings you down, or the third drink. If you can understand that, you can begin to take a bit more control. And I think that's what makes people feel happier.
Mm. And you encourage us to strip naked, to look in the mirror, to really understand who we are.
Well, I think people talk a lot about what they want without actually understanding what they want. And so do you actually just want a series of people to go out with over the next 2 or 3 years because you're lonely, but you're actually traveling a lot and you don't really want to settle down and have to answer to someone? Or do you want someone to have children with and build for the next 15, 20 years? And I think it's important to be honest because it will inform how you build your life so that you can move in the direction to create the next stage of your life that you want.
Do you think that Me Too has affected how we find love, and is it the end of flirting?
I think for women in the age of Me Too right now, it's really complicated. I think there's a lot of stress on women feeling retro if they say they would like to meet someone and either get married or have children with them. And there's also a tremendous stress now on women being incredibly capable in the workplace, leaning in, you know, speaking out loud, which women can find sometimes difficult to do. And so there's incredible pressure on women to be able to do everything. And then, of course, if you have a biological clock ticking and you want to have a baby and you can't find anybody to have it with, there's then pressure to do it on your own. So I think we all need to sort of fess up that we all need each other and we're much happier sharing experiences with people than we are doing it on our own. I think Me Too has made that harder.
This is a book for women.
It's actually a book for everybody, and it's a book for every age and stage. It's for millennials looking for love. It's for people who are divorced or widowed and getting back out there and the landscape has changed. I'm happy for men. I'd love men to read it too, because men want relationships as much as women do. We always stress it. We always stress it, oh, this is really women. But I think that men crave intimacy too. And one of the people we talk to in the book, Gail Dines, who's an excellent psychologist and talks a lot about porn, talks about the shame that men feel around porn. And she lectures on college campuses. You cannot get a seat at her lectures because they're so popular with young people trying to figure this out.
Joanna, if you had to give us just one rule to take away from your book, what would it be?
I think be honest about what you want. Don't settle for someone pretending that you want what they want if you don't, because that's really hard to live with.
Joanna Culls, author of Love Rules. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Many thanks to my guest, Joanna Culls, author of Love Rules, How to Find a Real Relationship in a Digital World. It's published by HarperCollins. This is Meet the Writers. Thanks to the studio manager, George McDonough. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.